before becoming violently radicalized. During her 1976 murder trial, she was found hanged in her jail cell. Suicide or murder, still unclear. In 1962, Minoff had had a benign brain tumor surgically removed. The 1976 autopsy showed that remnants of the tumor and surgical scar tissue impinged on her amygdala. A second case concerns Charles Whitman, the 1966 Texas Tower sniper who, after killing his wife and mother, opened fire atop a tower at the University of Texas in Austin, killing 16 and wounding 32, one of the first school massacres. Whitman was literally an Eagle Scout and childhood choir boy, a happily married engineering major with an IQ in the 99th percentile. In the prior year, he had seen doctors complaining of severe headaches and violent impulses, e.g., to shoot people from the campus tower. He left notes by the bodies of his wife and his mother, proclaiming love and puzzlement at his actions. I cannot rationally pinpoint any specific reason for killing her. And let there be no doubt in your mind that I loved this woman with all my heart. His suicide note requested an autopsy of his brain, and that any money he had be given to a mental health foundation. The autopsy proved his intuition correct. Whitman had a glioblastoma tumor pressing on his amygdala. Did Whitman's tumor cause his violence? Probably not in a strict amygdaloid tumor equals murderer sense, as he had risk factors that interacted with his neurological issues. Whitman grew up being beaten by his father and watching his mother and siblings experience the same. This choir boy Eagle Scout had repeatedly physically abused his wife and had been court-martialed as a Marine for physically threatening another soldier. And, perhaps indicative of a thread running through the family, his brother was murdered at age 24 during a bar fight. Footnote. Wait, don't the Marines want you to be physically threatening? Don't they train you to be that way? This is a great example of the big theme of this book, namely the context dependency of our best and worst behaviors. What the Marines train people for is to be majorly physically threatening, in certain contexts only. A whole other domain of amygdaloid function to the center stage. Thus, considerable evidence implicates the amygdala in aggression. But if you ask amygdala experts what behavior their favorite brain structure brings to mind, aggression wouldn't top their list. It would be fear and anxiety. Crucially, the brain region most involved in feeling afraid and anxious is most involved in generating aggression. The amygdala fear link is based on evidence similar to that supporting the amygdala aggression link. In lab animals, this has involved lesioning the structure, detecting activity in its neurons with recording electrodes, electrically stimulating it, or manipulating genes in it. All suggest a key role for the amygdala in perceiving fear-provoking stimuli and in expressing fear. Moreover, fear activates the amygdala in humans, with more activation predicting more behavioral signs of fear. In one study, subjects in a brain scanner played a Ms. Pac-Man from Hell video game where they were pursued in a maze by a dot. If caught, they'd be shocked. When people were evading the dot, the amygdala was silent. However, its activity increased as the dot approached. The stronger the shocks, the farther away the dot would be when first activating the amygdala. The stronger the activation, and the larger the self-reported feeling of panic. In another study, subjects waited an unknown length of time to receive a shock. This lack of predictability and control was so aversive that many chose to receive a stronger shock immediately. And in the others, the period of anticipatory dread increasingly activated the amygdala. Thus, the human amygdala preferentially responds to fear-evoking stimuli, even stimuli so fleeting as to be below conscious detection. Powerful support for an amygdaloid role in fear processing comes from post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. In PTSD sufferers, the amygdala is overreactive to mildly fearful stimuli and is slow in calming down after being activated. Moreover, the amygdala expands in size with long-term PTSD, This role of stress in this expansion will be covered in chapter 4. The amygdala is also involved in the expression of anxiety. Take a deck of cards. Half are black, half are red. How much would you wager that the top card is red? That's about risk. Here's a deck of cards. At least one is black, at least one is red. How much would you wager that the top card is red? That's about ambiguity. The circumstances carry identical probabilities, but people are made more anxious by the second scenario and activate the amygdala more. The amygdala is particularly sensitive to unsettling circumstances that are social. A high-ranking male rhesus monkey is in a sexual consortship with a female. In one condition, the female is placed in another room where the male can see her. In the second, she's in the other room along with a rival of the male. No surprise, that situation activates the amygdala. Is that about aggression or anxiety? Seemingly the latter. The extent of activation did not correlate with the amount of aggressive behaviors and vocalizations the male made, or the amount of testosterone secreted. Instead, it correlated with the extent of anxiety displayed, e.g., teeth chattering or self-scratching. The amygdala is linked to social uncertainty in other ways. In one neuroimaging study, a subject would participate in a competitive game against a group of other players. Outcomes were rigged so that the subject would wind up in the middle of the rankings. Experimenters then manipulated game outcomes so that subjects' rankings either remained stable or fluctuated wildly. Stable rankings activated parts of the frontal cortex that we'll soon consider. Instability activated the frontal cortex plus the amygdala. Being unsure of your place is unsettling. Another study explored the neurobiology of conforming. To simplify, a subject is part of a group, where, secretly, the rest are confederates. They are shown X, then asked, "What did you see?" Everyone else says Y. Does the subject lie and say Y also? Often. Subjects who stuck to their guns with X showed amygdala activation. Finally, activating specific circuits within the amygdala in mice turns anxiety on and off. Activating others made mice unable to distinguish between safe and anxiety-producing settings. By the way, what does mouse anxiety look like? Mice dislike bright lights and open spaces. Go figure, for a nocturnal animal that lots of species like to eat. So one measure of mouse anxiety is how long it takes for a mouse to go into the center of a brightly lit area to get some food. The amygdala also helps mediate both innate and learned fear. The core of innate fear, aka a phobia, is that you don't have to learn by trial and error that something is aversive. For example, a rat born in a lab, who has interacted only with other rats and grad students, instinctually fears and avoids the smell of cats. While different phobias activate somewhat different brain circuitry, for example, dentist phobia involves the cortex more than does snake phobia, they all activate the amygdala. Such innate fear contrasts with things we learn to fear. A bad neighborhood. A letter from the IRS. The dichotomy between innate and learned fear is actually a bit fuzzy. Everyone knows that humans are innately afraid of snakes and spiders, but some people keep them as pets, give them cute names. Instead of inevitable fear, we show prepared learning. Learning to be afraid of snakes and spiders more readily than of pandas or beagles. The same occurs in other primates. For example, lab monkeys who have never encountered snakes or artificial flowers can be conditioned to fear the former more readily than the latter. As we'll see in the next chapter, humans show prepared learning, being predisposed to be conditioned to fear people with a certain type of appearance. The fuzzy distinction between innate and learned fear maps nicely onto the amygdala's structure. The evolutionarily ancient central amygdala plays a key role in innate fears. Surrounding it is the basolateral amygdala, BLA, which is more recently evolved and somewhat resembles the fancy modern cortex. It's the BLA that learns fear and then sends the news to the central amygdala. Joseph Ledoux at New York University has shown how the BLA learns fear. Expose a rat to an innate trigger of fear, a shock. When this unconditioned stimulus occurs, the central amygdala activates, stress hormones are secreted, the sympathetic nervous system mobilizes, and, as a clear endpoint, the rat freezes in place. What was that? What do I do? Now do some conditioning. Before each shock, expose the rat to a stimulus that normally does not evoke fear, such as a tone. And with repeated coupling of the tone, the conditioned stimulus, with the shock, the unconditioned one, fear conditioning occurs. The sound of the tone alone elicits freezing, stress hormone release, and so on. Footnote. This is termed Pavlovian conditioning, in a nod to Ivan Pavlov. It's the same process by which Pavlov's dogs learned to associate the conditioned stimulus of a bell with the unconditioned stimulus of food, so that the former eventually was able to provoke salivation. Less reliable are operant conditioning approaches in which the degree to which something is scary is assessed by how much an individual will work to avoid being exposed to it. Ledoux and others have shown how auditory information about the tone stimulates BLA neurons. At first, activation of those neurons is irrelevant to the central amygdala, whose neurons are destined to activate following the shock. But with repeated coupling of tone with shock, there is remapping, and those BLA neurons acquire the means to activate the central amygdala. BLA neurons that respond to the tone only once conditioning has occurred would also have responded if conditioning instead had been to a light. In other words, these neurons respond to the meaning of the stimulus rather than to its specific modality. Moreover, if you electrically stimulate them, rats are easier to fear condition. You've lowered the threshold for this association to be made. And if you electrically stimulate the auditory sensory input at the same time as shocks, i.e., there's no tone, just activation of the pathway that normally carries news of the tone to the amygdala, you cause fear conditioning to a tone. You've engineered the learning of a false fear. There are synaptic changes as well. Once conditioning to a tone has occurred, the synapses coupling the BLA and central nucleus neurons have become more excitable. How this occurs is understood at the level of changes in the amount of receptors for excitatory neurotransmitters in dendritic spines in these circuits. Furthermore, conditioning increases levels of growth factors, which prompt the growth of new connections between BLA and central amygdala neurons. Some of the genes involved have even been identified. We've now got learning to be afraid under our belts. Now conditions change. The tone still occurs now and then, but no more shock. Gradually, the conditioned fear response abates. How does fear extinction occur? How do we learn that this person wasn't so scary after all? That different doesn't necessarily equal frightening. Recall how a subset of BLA neurons respond to the tone only once conditioning has occurred. Another population does the opposite, responding to the tone once it's no longer signaling shock. Logically, the two populations of neurons inhibit each other. Where do these, oh, the tone isn't scary anymore, neurons get inputs from? The frontal cortex. When we stop fearing something, it isn't because some amygdaloid neurons have lost their excitability. We don't passively forget that something is scary. We actively learn that it isn't anymore. The amygdala also plays a logical role in social and emotional decision-making. In the ultimatum game, an economic game involving two players, the first makes an offer as to how to divide a pot of money, which the other player either accepts or rejects. If the latter, neither gets anything. Research shows that rejecting an offer is an emotional decision, triggered by anger at a lousy offer and the desire to punish. The more the amygdala activation in the second player after an offer, the more likely the rejection. People with damaged amygdalae are atypically generous in the ultimatum game and don't increase rejection rates if they start receiving unfair offers. Why? These individuals understand the rules and can give sound, strategic advice to other players. Moreover, they use the same strategies as control subjects in a non-social version of the game when believing the other player is a computer. And they don't have a particularly long view, undistracted by the amygdala's emotional tumult, reasoning that their non-contingent generosity will induce reciprocity and pay off in the long run. When asked, they anticipate the same levels of reciprocity as do controls. Instead, these findings suggest that the amygdala injects implicit distrust and vigilance into social decision-making, all thanks to learning. In the words of the authors of the study, the generosity in the trust game of our BLA-damaged subjects might be considered pathological altruism, in the sense that inborn altruistic behaviors have not, due to BLA damage, been unlearned through negative social experience. In other words, the default state is to trust, and what the amygdala does is learn vigilance and distrust. Unexpectedly, the amygdala and one of its hypothalamic targets also play a role in male sexual motivation. Other hypothalamic nuclei are central to male sexual performance, but not female. What's that about? One neuroimaging study shed some light. Young heterosexual men looked at pictures of attractive women versus, as a control, of attractive men. Passively observing the pictures activated the reward circuitry just alluded to. In contrast, working to see the pictures by repeatedly pressing a button also activated the amygdala. Similarly, other studies show that the amygdala is most responsive to positive stimuli when the value of the reward is shifting. Moreover, some BLA neurons that respond in that circumstance also respond when the severity of something aversive is shifting. These neurons are paying attention to change, independent of direction. For them, the amount of reward is changing and the amount of punishment is changing are the same. Studies like these clarify that the amygdala isn't about the pleasure of experiencing pleasure. It's about the uncertain, unsettled yearning for a potential pleasure, the anxiety and fear and anger that the reward may be smaller than anticipated, or may not even happen. It's about how many of our pleasures and our pursuits of them contain a corrosive vein of dis-ease. The amygdala as part of networks in the brain. Now that we know about the subparts of the amygdala, it's informative to consider its extrinsic connections, i.e., what parts of the brain send projection to it, and what parts does it project to. Some inputs to the amygdala. Sensory inputs. For starters, the amygdala, specifically the BLA, gets projections from all the sensory systems. How else can you get terrified by the shark's theme music in Jaws? Normally, sensory information from various modalities, eyes, ears, skin, courses into the brain, reaching the appropriate cortical region, visual cortex, auditory cortex, tactile cortex, for processing. For example, the visual cortex would engage layers and layers of neurons to turn pixels of retinal stimulation into recognizable images before it can scream to the amygdala, "It's a gun!" Importantly, some sensory information entering the brain takes a shortcut, bypassing the cortex and going directly to the amygdala. Thus, the amygdala can be informed about something scary before the cortex has a clue. Moreover, thanks to the extreme excitability of this pathway, the amygdala can respond to stimuli that are too fleeting or faint for the cortex to note. Additionally, the shortcut projections form stronger, more excitable synapses in the BLA than do the ones from the sensory cortex. Emotional arousal enhances fear conditioning through this pathway. This shortcut's power is shown in the case of a man with stroke damage to his visual cortex, producing cortical blindness. While unable to process most visual information, he still recognized emotional facial expressions via the shortcut. Crucially, while sensory information reaches the amygdala rapidly by this shortcut, it isn't terribly accurate, since, after all, accuracy is what the cortex applies. As we'll see in the next chapter, this produces tragic circumstances where, say, the amygdala decides it's seeing a handgun before the visual cortex can report that it's actually a cell phone. Information about pain. The amygdala receives news of that reliable trigger of fear and aggression, namely pain. This is mediated by projections from an ancient core brain structure, the periaqueductal gray, PAG. Stimulation of the PAG can evoke panic attacks, and it is enlarged in people with chronic panic attacks, reflecting the amygdala's roles in vigilance, uncertainty, anxiety, and fear. It's unpredictable pain, rather than pain itself, that activates the amygdala. Pain, and the amygdala's response to it, is all about context. Disgust of all stripes. The amygdala also receives a hugely interesting projection from the insular cortex, an honorary part of the prefrontal cortex, which we will consider at length in later chapters. If you, or any other mammal, bite into rancid food, the insular cortex lights up, causing you to spit it out, gag, feel nauseated, make a revolted facial expression. The insular cortex processes gustatory disgust. Ditto for disgusting smells. Remarkably, humans also activate it by thinking about something morally disgusting. Social norm violations, or individuals who are typically stigmatized in society. And in that circumstance, its activation drives that of the amygdala. Someone does something lousy and selfish to you in a game, and the extent of insular and amygdaloid activation predicts how much outrage you feel and how much revenge you take. This is all about sociality. The insula and amygdala don't activate if it's a computer that has stabbed you in the back. The insula activates when we eat a cockroach or imagine doing so. And the insula and amygdala activate when we think of the neighboring tribe as loathsome cockroaches. As we'll see, this is central to how our brain processes us and them. And finally, the amygdala gets tons of inputs from the frontal cortex. Much more to come. Some outputs from the amygdala. Bidirectional connections. As we'll see, the amygdala talks to many of the regions that talk to it, including the frontal cortex, insula, periaqueductal gray, and sensory projections, modulating their sensitivity. The amygdala/hippocampus interface. Naturally, the amygdala talks to other limbic structures, including the hippocampus. As reviewed, typically the amygdala learns fear, and the hippocampus learns detached, dispassionate facts. But at times of extreme fear, the amygdala pulls the hippocampus into a type of fear learning. Back to the rat undergoing fear conditioning. When it's in cage A, a tone is followed by a shock. But in cage B, the tone isn't. This produces context-dependent conditioning. The tone causes fearful freezing in cage A, but not in cage B. The amygdala learns the stimulus cue, the tone, while the hippocampus learns about the contexts of cage A versus B. The coupled learning between amygdala and hippocampus is very focalized. We all remember the view of the plane hitting the Second World Trade Center tower, but not whether there were clouds in the background. The hippocampus decides whether a factoid is worth filing away, depending on whether the amygdala has gotten worked up over it. Moreover, the coupling can rescale. Suppose someone robs you at gunpoint in an alley in a bad part of town. Afterward, depending on the circumstance, the gun can be the cue and the alley the context, or the alley is the cue and the bad part of town the context. Motor outputs. There's a second shortcut regarding the amygdala, specifically when it's talking to motor neurons that command movement. Logically, when the amygdala wants to mobilize a behavior, say fleeing, it talks to the frontal cortex, seeking its executive approval. But if sufficiently aroused, the amygdala talks directly to subcortical reflexive motor pathways. Again, there's a trade-off. Increased speed by bypassing the cortex, but decreased accuracy. Thus, the input shortcut may prompt you to see the cell phone as a gun, and the output shortcut may prompt you to pull a trigger before you consciously mean to. Arousal. Ultimately, amygdala outputs are mostly about setting off alarms throughout the brain and body. As we saw, the core of the amygdala is the central amygdala. Axonal projections from there go to an amygdala-ish structure nearby called the bed nucleus of the stria terminalis, BNST. The BNST, in turn, projects to parts of the hypothalamus that initiate the hormonal stress response, see Chapter 4, as well as to midbrain and brain stem sites that activate the sympathetic nervous system and inhibit the parasympathetic nervous system. Something emotionally arousing occurs, layer 2 limbic amygdala signals layer 1 regions, and heart rate and blood pressure soar. The amygdala also activates a brainstem structure called the locus coeruleus, akin to the brain's own sympathetic nervous system. It sends norepinephrine-releasing projections throughout the brain, particularly the cortex. If the locus coeruleus is drowsy and silent, so are you. If it's moderately activated, you're alert. And if it's firing like gangbusters, thanks to inputs from an aroused amygdala, all neuronal hands are on deck. The amygdala's projection pattern raises an important point. When is the sympathetic nervous system going full blast? During fear, flight, fight, and sex. Or if you've won the lottery, are happily sprinting down a soccer field, or have just solved Fermat's theorem, if you're that kind of person. Reflecting this, about a quarter of neurons in one hypothalamic nucleus are involved in both sexual behavior and, when stimulated at a higher intensity, aggressive behavior in male mice. This has two implications. Both sex and aggression activate the sympathetic nervous system, which in turn can influence behavior. People feel differently about things if, say, their heart is racing versus beating slowly. Does this mean that the pattern of your autonomic arousal influences what you feel? Not really, but autonomic feedback influences the intensity of what is felt. More on this in the next chapter. The second consequence reflects a core idea of this book. Your heart does roughly the same thing whether you are in a murderous rage or having an orgasm. Again, the opposite of love is not hate. It's indifference. This concludes our overview of the amygdala. Amid the jargon and complexity, the most important theme is the amygdala's dual role in both aggression and facets of fear and anxiety. Fear and aggression are not inevitably intertwined. Not all fear causes aggression, and not all aggression is rooted in fear. Fear typically increases aggression only in those already prone to it. Among the subordinate, who lack the option of expressing aggression safely, fear does the opposite. The dissociation between fear and aggression is evident in violent psychopaths, who are the antithesis of fearful. Both physiologically and subjectively, they are less reactive to pain. Their amygdalae are relatively unresponsive to typical fear-evoking stimuli and are smaller than normal. This fits with the picture of psychopathic violence. It is not done in aroused reaction to provocation. Instead, it is purely instrumental, using others as a means to an end with emotionless, remorseless, reptilian indifference. Thus, fear and violence are not always connected at the hip. But a connection is likely when the aggression evoked is reactive, frenzied, and flecked with spittle. In a world in which no amygdaloid neuron need be afraid and instead can sit under its vine and fig tree, the world is very likely to be a more peaceful place. We now move to the second of the three brain regions we're considering in detail. The frontal cortex. I've spent decades studying the hippocampus. It's been good to me. I'd like to think I've been the same in return. Yet I think I might have made the wrong choice back then. Maybe I should have studied the frontal cortex all these years, because it's the most interesting part of the brain. What does the frontal cortex do? Its list of expertise includes working memory, executive function, organizing knowledge strategically, and then initiating an action based on an executive decision, gratification postponement, long-term planning, regulation of emotions, and reining in impulsivity. This is a sprawling portfolio. I will group these varied functions under a single definition pertinent to every page of this book. The frontal cortex makes you do the harder thing when it's the right thing to do. To start, here are some important features of the frontal cortex. It's the most recently evolved brain region, not approaching full splendor until the emergence of primates. A disproportionate percentage of genes unique to primates are active in the frontal cortex. Moreover, such gene expression patterns are highly individuated, with greater inter-individual variability than average levels of whole brain differences between humans and chimps. The human frontal cortex is more complexly wired than in other apes, and, by some definitions as to its boundaries, proportionately bigger as well. The frontal cortex is the last brain region to fully mature, with the most evolutionarily recent subparts the very last. Amazingly, it's not fully online until people are in their mid-twenties. You'd better bet this factoid will be relevant to the chapter about adolescence. Finally, the frontal cortex has a unique cell type. In general, the human brain isn't unique because we've evolved unique types of neurons, neurotransmitters, enzymes, and so on. Human and fly neurons are remarkably similar. The uniqueness is quantitative. For every fly neuron, we have a gazillion more neurons and a bazillion more connections. The sole exception is an obscure type of neuron with a distinctive shape and pattern of wiring, called von Economo neurons, aka spindle neurons. At first, they seem to be unique to humans, but we've now found them in other primates, whales, dolphins, and elephants. Footnote. Strongly suggesting that these neurons independently evolved on three separate occasions, giving the evolutionary distances between primates, cetaceans, and elephants. The nearest relatives of elephants, for example, are hyraxes and manatees. The convergent evolution of von Economo neurons from three separate lineages emphasizes that these cells go hand in hand with major sociality. That's an all-star team of socially complex species. Moreover, the few von Economo neurons occur only in two subregions of the frontal cortex, as shown by John Allman at Caltech. One we've heard about already, the insula, with its role in gustatory and moral disgust. The second is an equally interesting area called the anterior cingulate. To give a hint, with more to come, it's central to empathy. So from the standpoint of evolution, size, complexity, development, genetics, and neuron type, the frontal cortex is distinctive, with a human version the most unique. The subregions of the frontal cortex. Frontal cortical anatomy is hellishly complicated, and there are debates as to whether some parts of the primate frontal cortex even exist in simpler species. Nonetheless, there are some useful broad themes. In the very front is the prefrontal cortex, PFC, the newest part of the frontal cortex. As noted, the frontal cortex is central to executive function. To quote George W. Bush, within the frontal cortex, it's the PFC that is the decider. Most broadly, the PFC chooses between conflicting options, Coke or Pepsi, blurting out what you really think or restraining yourself, pulling the trigger or not. And often the conflict being resolved is between a decision heavily driven by cognition and one driven by emotions. Once it has decided, the PFC sends orders via projections to the rest of the frontal cortex sitting just behind it. Those neurons then talk to the premotor cortex sitting just behind it, which then passes it to the motor cortex, which talks to your muscles. And a behavior ensues. Footnote. To give a sense of this, consider someone deciding whether to press a button. The frontal cortex makes its decision. Know its neurons' firing patterns, and you can predict the decision with 80% accuracy about 700 milliseconds before the person is consciously aware of their decision. Before considering how the frontal cortex influences social behavior, let's start with a simpler domain of its function. The frontal cortex and cognition. What does doing the harder thing when it's the right thing to do look like in the realm of cognition, defined by Princeton's Jonathan Cohen as the ability to orchestrate thought and action in accordance with internal goals? Suppose you've looked up a phone number in a city where you once lived. The frontal cortex not only remembers it long enough to dial, but also considers it strategically. Just before dialing, you consciously recall that it is in that other city and retrieve your memory of the city's area code. And then you remember to dial 1 before the area code. The frontal cortex is also concerned with focusing on a task. If you step off the curb, planning to jaywalk, you look at traffic, paying attention to motion, calculating whether you can cross safely. If you step off, looking for a taxi, you pay attention to whether a car has one of those lit taxicab thingies on top. In a great study, monkeys were trained to look at a screen of dots of various colors moving in particular directions. Depending on a signal, a monkey had to pay attention to either color or movement. Each signal indicating a shift in tasks triggered a burst of PFC activity and, coupled with that, suppression of the stream of information, color or movement, that was now irrelevant. This is the PFC getting you to do the harder thing. Remembering that the rule has changed. Don't do the previous habitual response. The frontal cortex also mediates executive function, considering bits of information, looking for patterns, and then choosing a strategic action. Consider this truly frontally demanding test. The experimenter tells a masochistic volunteer, "I'm going to the market and I'm going to buy peaches, cornflakes, laundry detergent, cinnamon," 16 items recited. The volunteer is asked to repeat the list. Maybe they correctly recall the first few. The last few list some near misses, say nutmeg instead of cinnamon. Then the experimenter repeats the same list. This time the volunteer remembers a few more, avoids repeating the nutmeg incident. Now do it again and again. This is more than a simple memory test. With repetition, subjects notice that 4 of the items are fruits, 4 for cleaning, 4 spices, 4 carbs. They come in categories. And this changes subjects' encoding strategy as they start clumping by semantic group. Peaches, apples, blueberries. No, I mean blackberries. There was another fruit, can't remember what. Okay, cornflakes, bread, donuts, muffins, cumin, nutmeg. Cinnamon, oregano. And throughout, the PFC imposes an overarching executive strategy for remembering these 16 factoids. The PFC is essential for categorical thinking, for organizing and thinking about bits of information with different labels. The PFC groups apples and peaches as closer to each other in a conceptual map than are apples and toilet plungers. In a relevant study, monkeys were trained to differentiate between pictures of a dog and of a cat. The PFC contained individual neurons that responded to dog and others that responded to cat. Now the scientists morphed the pictures together, creating hybrids with varying percentages of dog and cat. Dog PFC neurons responded about as much to hybrids that were 80% dog and 20% cat, or 60-40. As to 100% dog. But not to 40-60. Cat neurons would kick in there. The frontal cortex aids the underdog outcome, fueled by thoughts supplied from influences that fill the rest of this book. Stop. Those aren't your cookies. You'll go to hell. Self-discipline is good. You're happier when you're thinner. All giving some lone inhibitory motor neuron more of a fighting chance. Frontal metabolism and an implicit vulnerability. This raises an important point, pertinent to the social as well as cognitive functions of the frontal cortex. All this, "I wouldn't do that if I were you-ing" by the frontal cortex, is taxing. Other brain regions respond to instances of some contingency. The frontal cortex tracks rules. Just think how around age 3, our frontal cortices learned a rule followed for the rest of our lives, don't pee whenever you feel like it, and gained the means to enact that rule by increasing their influence over neurons regulating the bladder. Moreover, the frontal mantra of self-discipline is good, when cookies beckon, is also invoked when economizing to increase retirement savings. Frontal cortical neurons are generalists, with broad patterns of projections, which makes for more work. All this takes energy, and when it is working hard, the frontal cortex has an extremely high metabolic rate and rates of activation of genes related to energy production. Willpower is more than just a metaphor. Self-control is a finite resource. Frontal neurons are expensive cells, and expensive cells are vulnerable cells. Consistent with that, the frontal cortex is atypically vulnerable to various neurological insults. Pertinent to this is the concept of cognitive load. Make the frontal cortex work hard, a tough working memory task, regulating social behavior, or making numerous decisions while shopping. Immediately afterward, performance on a different frontally dependent task declines. Likewise, during multitasking, where PFC neurons simultaneously participate in multiple activated circuits. Importantly, increase cognitive load on the frontal cortex, and afterward, subjects become less pro-social, less charitable or helpful, more likely to lie. Or increase cognitive load with a task requiring difficult emotional regulation, and subjects cheat more on their diets afterward. So the frontal cortex is awash in Calvinist self-discipline, a superego with its nose to the grindstone. But as an important qualifier, soon after we're potty trained, doing the harder thing with our bladder muscles becomes automatic. Likewise with other initially demanding frontal tasks. For example, you're learning a piece of music on the piano. There's a difficult trill, and each time as you approach it, you think, "Here it comes. Remember, tuck my elbow in, lead with my thumb." A classic working memory task. And then one day, you realize that you're 5 measures past the trill. It went fine, and you didn't have to think about it. And that's when doing the trill is transferred from the frontal cortex to more reflexive brain regions, e.g. the cerebellum. This transition to automaticity also happens when you get good at a sport, when metaphorically your body knows what to do without your thinking about it. The chapter on morality considers automaticity in a more important realm. Is resisting lying a demanding task for your frontal cortex, or is it effortless habit? As we'll see, honesty often comes more easily thanks to automaticity. This helps explain the answer typically given after someone has been profoundly brave. "What were you thinking when you dove into the river to save that drowning child?" "I wasn't thinking. Before I knew it, I had jumped in." Often the neurobiology of automaticity mediates doing the hardest moral acts, while the neurobiology of the frontal cortex mediates working hard on a term paper about the subject. The frontal cortex and social behavior. Things get interesting when the frontal cortex has to add social factors to a cognitive mix. For example, one part of the monkey PFC contains neurons that activate when the monkey makes a mistake on a cognitive task or observes another monkey doing so. Some activate only when it's a particular animal who made the mistake. In a neuroimaging study, humans had to choose something, balancing feedback obtained from their own prior choices with advice from another person. Different PFC circuits tracked reward-driven and advice-driven cogitating. Findings like these segue into the central role of the frontal cortex in social behavior. This is appreciated when comparing various primates. Across primate species, the bigger the size of the average social group, the larger the relative size of the frontal cortex. This is particularly so with fission fusion species, where there are times when subgroups split up and function independently for a while before regrouping. Such a social structure is demanding, requiring the scaling of appropriate behavior to subgroup size and composition. Logically, primates from fission fusion species, chimps, bonobos, orangutans, spider monkeys, have better frontocortical inhibitory control over behavior than do non-fission fusion primates, gorillas, capuchins, macaques. Among humans, the larger someone's social network, measured by number of different people texted, the larger a particular PFC subregion. Stay tuned. That's cool, but we can't tell if the big brain region causes the sociality or the reverse, assuming there's causality. Another study resolves this. If rhesus monkeys are randomly placed into social groups, over the subsequent 15 months, the bigger the group, the larger the PFC becomes. Social complexity expands the frontal cortex. We utilize the frontal cortex to do the harder thing in social contexts. We praise the hosts for the inedible dinner. Refrain from hitting the infuriating coworker. Don't make sexual advances to someone, despite our fantasies. Don't belch loudly during the eulogy. A great way to appreciate the frontal cortex is to consider what happens when it is damaged. The first frontal patient, the famous Phineas Gage, was identified in 1848 in Vermont. Gage, the foreman on a railroad construction crew, was injured when an accident with blasting powder blew a 13-pound iron tamping rod through the left side of his face and out the top front of his skull. It landed 80 feet away, along with much of his left frontal cortex. Remarkably, he survived and recovered his health, but the respected, even-keeled Gage was transformed. In the words of the doctor who followed him over the years, "The equilibrium, or balance, so to speak, between his intellectual faculties and animal propensities seems to have been destroyed. He is fitful, irreverent, indulging at times in the grossest profanity, which was not previously his custom, manifesting but little deference for his fellows, impatient of restraint or advice when it conflicts with his desires, at times pertinaciously obstinate, yet capricious and vacillating, devising many plans of future operations which are no sooner arranged than they are abandoned in turn for others appearing more feasible." Gage was described by friends as no longer Gage, was incapable of resuming his job, and was reduced to appearing, with his rod, as an exhibit displayed by P.T. Barnum. Poignant as hell. Amazingly, Gage got better. Within a few years of his injury, he could resume work, mostly as a stagecoach driver, and was described as being broadly appropriate in his behavior. His remaining right frontal cortical tissue had taken on some of the functions lost in the injury. Such malleability of the brain is the focus of Chapter 5. Another example of what happens when the frontal cortex is damaged is observed in frontotemporal dementia, FTD, which starts by damaging the frontal cortex. Intriguingly, the first neurons killed are those mysterious von Economo neurons that are unique to primates, elephants, and cetaceans. What are people with FTD like? They exhibit behavioral disinhibition and socially inappropriate behaviors. There's also an apathy and lack of initiating behavior that reflects the fact that the decider is being destroyed. Footnote. The apathy is in contrast to early-stage Alzheimer's sufferers who, after making some horrible social blunder due to memory problems, say, asking after the health of someone's spouse because they didn't remember that the person died years ago, are mortified. Something similar is seen in Huntington's disease, a horrific disorder due to a thoroughly weird mutation. Subcortical circuits that coordinate signaling to muscles are destroyed, and the sufferer is progressively incapacitated by involuntary writhing movements. Except that it turns out that there is frontal damage as well, often before the subcortical damage. In about half the patients, there's also behavioral disinhibition, stealing, aggressiveness, hypersexuality, bursts of compulsive, inexplicable gambling. Social and behavioral disinhibition also occur in individuals with stroke damage in the frontal cortex. For example, sexually assaultive behavior in an octogenarian. There's another circumstance where the frontal cortex is hypofunctional, producing similar behavioral manifestations, hypersexuality, outbursts of emotion, flamboyantly illogical acts. What disease is this? It isn't. You're dreaming. During REM sleep, when dreaming occurs, the frontal cortex goes offline, and dream scriptwriters run wild. Moreover, if the frontal cortex is stimulated while people are dreaming, the dreams become less dreamlike, with more self-awareness. And there's another non-pathological circumstance where the PFC silences, producing emotional tsunamis. During orgasm. One last realm of frontal damage. Adrian Rain of the University of Pennsylvania and Kent Keel of the University of New Mexico report that criminal psychopaths have decreased activity in the frontal cortex and less coupling of the PFC to other brain regions, compared with non-psychopathic criminals and non-criminal controls. Moreover, a shockingly large percentage of people incarcerated for violent crimes have a history of concussive trauma to the frontal cortex. More to come in Chapter 16. The obligatory declaration of the falseness of the dichotomy between cognition and emotion. The PFC consists of various parts, subparts, and sub-subparts, enough to keep neuroanatomists off the dole. Two regions are crucial. First, there is the dorsal part of the PFC, especially the dorsolateral PFC, DLPFC. Don't worry about dorsal or dorsolateral. It's just jargon. The DLPFC is the decider of deciders, the most rational, cognitive, utilitarian, unsentimental part of the PFC. It's the most recently evolved part of the PFC and the last part to fully mature. It mostly hears from and talks to other cortical regions. In contrast to the DLPFC, there's the ventral part of the PFC, particularly the ventromedial PFC, VMPFC. This is the frontocortical region that the visionary neuroanatomist Nauta made an honorary member of the limbic system because of its interconnections with it. Logically, the VMPFC is all about the impact of emotion on decision-making. And many of our best and worst behaviors involve interactions of the VMPFC with the limbic system and DLPFC. The functions of the cognitive DLPFC are the essence of doing the harder thing. It's the most active frontocortical region when someone forgoes an immediate reward for a bigger one later. Consider a classic moral quandary. Is it okay to kill one innocent person to save five? When people ponder the question, greater DLPFC activation predicts a greater likelihood of answering yes. But as we'll see in Chapter 13, it also depends on how you ask the question. Monkeys with DLPFC lesions can't switch strategies in a task when the rewards given for each strategy shift. They perseverate with a strategy offering the most immediate reward. Similarly, humans with DLPFC damage are impaired in planning or gratification postponement, perseverate on strategies that offer immediate reward, and show poor executive control over their behavior. Remarkably, the technique of transcranial magnetic stimulation can temporarily silence part of someone's cortex, as was done in a fascinating study by Ernst Fehr of the University of Zurich. When the DLPFC was silenced, subjects playing an economic game impulsively accepted lousy offers that they'd normally reject in the hopes of getting better offers in the future. Crucially, this was about sociality. Silencing the DLPFC had no effect if subjects thought the other player was a computer. Moreover, controls and subjects with silenced DLPFCs rated lousy offers as being equally unfair. Thus, as concluded by the authors, subjects with the silenced DLPFC behave as if they can no longer implement their fairness goals. What are the functions of the emotional VMPFC? What you'd expect, given its inputs from limbic structures. It activates if the person you're rooting for wins a game, or if you listen to pleasant versus dissonant music, particularly if the music provokes a shiver down the spine moment. What are the effects of VM-PFC damage? Lots of things remain normal: intelligence, working memory, making estimates. Individuals can do the harder thing with purely cognitive frontal tasks, e.g. puzzles where you have to give up a step of progress in order to gain two more. The differences appear when it comes to making social/emotional decisions. VM-PFC patients just can't decide. They understand the options and can sagely advise someone else in similar circumstances, but the closer to home and the more emotional the scenario, the more they have problems. Damasio has produced an influential theory about emotion-laden decision-making rooted in the philosophies of Hume and William James. This will soon be discussed. Briefly, the frontal cortex runs as if experiments of gut feelings. How would I feel if this outcome occurred? And makes choices with the answer in mind. Damaging the VM-PFC, thus removing limbic input to the PFC, eliminates gut feelings, making decisions harder. Moreover, eventual decisions are highly utilitarian. VM-PFC patients are atypically willing to sacrifice one person, including a family member, to save five strangers. They're more interested in outcomes than in their underlying emotional motives. Punishing someone who accidentally kills, but not one who tried to kill but failed, because after all, no one died in the second case. It's Mr. Spock running on only the DLPFC. Now for a crucial point. People who dichotomize between thought and emotion often prefer the former, viewing emotion as suspect. It gums up decision-making by getting sentimental, sings too loudly, dresses flamboyantly, has unsettling amounts of armpit hair. In this view, get rid of the VM-PFC and we'd be more rational and function better. But that's not the case, as emphasized eloquently by Damasio. People with VM-PFC damage not only have trouble making decisions, but also make bad ones. They show poor judgment in choosing friends and partners and don't shift behavior based on negative feedback. For example, consider a gambling task where reward rates for various strategies change without subjects knowing it, and subjects can shift their play strategy. Control subjects shift optimally, even if they can't verbalize how reward rates have changed. Those with VM-PFC damage don't, even when they can verbalize. Without a VM-PFC, you may know the meaning of negative feedback, but you don't know the feeling of it in your gut, and thus don't shift behavior. As we saw, without the DLPFC, the metaphorical superego is gone, resulting in individuals who are now hyper-aggressive, hypersexual ids. But without a VM-PFC, behavior is inappropriate in a detached way. This is the person who, encountering someone after a long time, says, "Hello, I see you've put on some weight." And when castigated later by their mortified spouse, they will say with calm puzzlement, "But it's true." The VM-PFC is not the vestigial appendix of the frontal cortex, where emotion is something akin to appendicitis, inflaming a sensible brain. Instead, it's essential. It wouldn't be if we had evolved into Vulcans. But as long as the world is filled with humans, evolution would never have made us that way. Activation of the DLPFC and VM-PFC can be inversely correlated. In an inspired study where a keyboard was provided to jazz pianists inside a brain scanner, the VM-PFC became more active and the DLPFC less so when subjects improvised. In another study, subjects judged hypothetical, harmful acts. Pondering perpetrator's responsibility activated the DLPFC. Deciding the amount of punishment activated the VM-PFC. When subjects did a gambling task where reward probabilities for various strategies shifted and they could always change strategies, decision-making reflected two factors. A, the outcome of their most recent action. The better that had turned out, the more of VMPFC activation, and B, reward rates from all the previous rounds, something requiring a long retrospective view. The better the long-term rewards, the more DLPFC activation. Relative activation between the two regions predicted the decision subjects made. A simplistic view is that the VMPFC and DLPFC perpetually battle for domination by emotion versus cognition. But while emotion and cognition can be somewhat separable, they're rarely in opposition. Instead, they are intertwined in a collaborative relationship needed for normal function. And as tasks with both emotive and cognitive components become more difficult, making an increasingly complex economic decision in a setting that is increasingly unfair, activity in the two structures becomes more synchronized. The frontal cortex and its relationship with the limbic system. We now have a sense of what different subdivisions of the PFC do and how cognition and emotion interact neurobiologically. This leads us to consider how the frontal cortex and limbic system interact. In landmark studies, Joshua Green of Harvard and Princeton's Cohen showed how the emotional and cognitive parts of the brain can somewhat dissociate. They used philosophy's famous runaway trolley problem, where a trolley is bearing down on five people, and you must decide if it's okay to kill one person to save the five. Framing of the problem is key. In one version, you pull a lever, diverting the trolley onto a sidetrack. This saves the five, but the trolley kills someone who happened to be on this other track. 70% to 90% of people say they would do this. In the second scenario, you push the person in front of the trolley with your own hands. This stops the trolley, but the person is killed. 70% to 90% say no way. The same numerical trade-off, but utterly different decisions. Green and Cohen gave subjects the two versions while neuroimaging them. Contemplating intentionally killing someone with your own hands activates the decider, DLPFC, along with emotion-related regions that respond to aversive stimuli, including a cortical region activated by emotionally laden words, the amygdala and the VMPFC. The more amygdaloid activation and the more negative emotions the participant reported in deciding, the less likely they were to push. And when people contemplate detachedly pulling a lever that inadvertently kills someone, the DLPFC alone activates. As purely cerebral a decision as choosing which wrench to use to fix a widget. A great study. Other studies have examined interactions between cognitive and emotional parts of the brain. A few examples. Chapter 3 discusses some unsettling research. Stick your average person in a brain scanner and show him a picture of someone of another race for only a tenth of a second. This is too fast for him to be aware of what he saw. But thanks to that anatomical shortcut, the amygdala knows and activates. In contrast, show the picture for a longer time. Again, the amygdala activates, but then the cognitive DLPFC does as well, inhibiting the amygdala. The effort to control what is for most people an unpalatable initial response. Chapter 6 discusses experiments where a subject plays a game with two other people and is manipulated into feeling that she is being left out. This activates her amygdala, periaqueductal gray, that ancient brain region that helps process physical pain, anterior cingulate, and insula. An anatomical picture of anger, anxiety, pain, disgust, sadness. Soon afterward, her PFC activates as rationalizations kick in. This is just a stupid game. I have friends. My dog loves me. And the amygdala et al. Quiet down. And what if you do the same to someone whose frontal cortex is not fully functional? The amygdala is increasingly activated. The person feels increasingly distressed. What neurological disease is involved? None. This is a typical teenager. Finally, the PFC mediates fear extinction. Yesterday, the rat learned that tone is followed by a shock, so the sound of the tone began to trigger freezing. Today, there are no shocks, and the rat has acquired another truth that takes precedence. But not today. the first truth is still there. As proof, start coupling tone with shock again, and freezing to tone is reinstated faster than the association was initially learned. Where is "but not today" consolidated? In the PFC, after receiving information from the hippocampus. The medial PFC activates inhibitory circuits in the BLA, and the rat stops freezing to the tone. In a similar vein, but reflecting cognition specific to humans, condition people to associate a blue square on a screen with a shock, and the amygdala will activate when seeing that square. But less so in subjects who reappraise the situation, activating the medial PFC by thinking of, say, a beautiful blue sky. This segues into the subject of regulating emotion through thought. It's hard to regulate thought. Try not thinking about a hippo. But even tougher with emotion. Research by my Stanford colleague and close friend, James Gross, has explored this. First off, thinking differently about something emotional differs from simply suppressing the expression of the emotions. For example, show someone graphic footage of, say, an amputation. Subjects cringe, activate the amygdala and sympathetic nervous system. Now, one group